This is the Preservation Technology Podcast, bringing innovation to preservation. The Preservation Technology Podcast is a production of the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training, a unit of the National Park Service. Hello, my name is Catherine Cooper. I am here with
Bobby Fiesler, and I am a journalist and queer historian and the author of a queer history book called Tinderbox about the 1973 Upstairs Lounge Fire in New Orleans.
Could you talk about what the Upstairs Lounge Fire was for people who may not know the story?
So historically, the Upstairs Lounge Fire was a notoriously unsolved arson fire that took place at a gay bar on like sort of the ragtag fringes of the New Orleans French Quarter. The gay bar was called the Upstairs Lounge, and the arson claimed 32 lives. It was the deadliest fire on record in New Orleans history and the worst mass murder of homosexual Americans in 20th century America. And yet this event, this calamity, which was very significant when it happened, received just a few days of media attention in its time due to its queer overtones, and thus was permitted to become the historic mystery that it remains now, the way it kind of lingers. The Upstairs Lounge Fire is still officially an unsolved crime, despite a bounty of evidence pointing towards the chief suspect, an internally conflicted gay-for-pay sex worker named Roger Dale Nunez, a man ejected from the Upstairs Lounge Fire minutes before the fire began, screaming the word burn, curiously enough. And despite the presence of this chief suspect, the Sunday night of June 24th, 1973, and Sunday nights were significant at the working class gay bar called the Upstairs Lounge. It was called the Upstairs Lounge because it was on the second story of a building and it was hidden from street view. You had to access it via a single staircase that was the lone entrance and exit that was winding. So you couldn't even see where you were going to as you were heading up the staircase. And Sunday nights were the biggest night of the week at the Upstairs Lounge. There was a drink special for working class gays and lesbians called the Beer Bust. So it was $1 for 2 hours of unlimited draft beer. Okay, this was New Orleans in the 70s. The fire itself, the calamity, was deemed a kind of political inconvenience in its time, a hot potato due to its queer overtones. And that's left us where it is now. The Upstairs Lounge Fire is an event on the map of queer history and American history now, but it still occupies an uncertain place where people don't know how to speak about it exactly.
So you open the book with a question, and I'd love to hear your answer. What does it mean to remember?
This was the question that occupied me as I was writing the entire book. What is the significance of it? Is it just a recitation of facts, right? Is it, do we remember for revenge? Do we remember for trauma porn so we can make ourselves feel sad or victimized in the current day and age? And I settled on it in the last line of the book. The first line and the last line of books tend to have a relationship. And as an author, I didn't even mean for that to happen. But so what does it mean for remember? And then the last few words of Tinderbox is speaking at last their names in reference to the victims. What it means to remember for me, as I've come to understand this crazy story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire that's occupied about 10 years of my life and continues to, and it's something I think about on a daily basis, is that we can't change the past by remembering it, but we can change the way we reflect upon the past through the manner in which we choose to remember it. So we can reflect upon the past in a way that's nihilistic, in a way that makes us feel powerless, or we can reflect upon the past in a way that tries to honor individuals who might be our forebearers, and in a way to try to offer some sort of symbolic restitution to people who did not receive respect or dignity or equal rights or equal treatment in the past. And that's what it means for me to remember. As I talk about the Upstairs Lounge, the more that I understand it is that history, and especially queer history or human rights history, occurs in this space of malleability, where there are events that transpired that are facts that predate us, that affect us all because we live in the stream of history. It's like the invisible person in the room whenever we meet and talk about queer subjects, oftentimes, especially in New Orleans. The Upstairs Lounge is just this persistent reality. And to remember it is an act of connecting ourselves to that lineage and at the same time transforming. And I hate to sound like a motivational speaker, I'm weird myself out here, but it's transforming acts of hatred, acts of confusion, acts of disrespect, acts of unbridled pain into some meaningful matter that we can then consider in the contemporary context and use in all sorts of different ways. It's sort of mana then to offer restitution to the past, the 32 victims of the Upstairs Lounge Fire who were denied respect and dignity in their lifetimes and in their deaths, actually. Many of the Upstairs Lounge victims did not receive religious burial, say. Or it can be used as a statement to say how far we've come. To talk about this now means that we are a society that can talk about these difficult queer topics, as opposed to contra this society in the past in the 1970s that couldn't talk about it. Or it's a statement of never again. What happened there, the conditions that created the Upstairs Lounge Fire, the fire itself, the fallout, never again. So it can mean all sorts of things. It's an active back and forth, isn't it, to remember and what we choose to remember and then what we choose to remember in a public way.
How has memory or storytelling around the fire changed since the event, both within the local community in New Orleans and outside of it, because it did have that national feature to it as well?
So in its day, in the 70s, the Upstairs Lounge Fire, when it occurred, it was this literally explosive event that involved fire bursting out of the windows of this second story gay bar that was sort of positioned like a castle keep, where people who passed by it every day didn't even know there was a massive gay bar up there. And they were forced to all stare and reckon with this calamity and this violence and people literally burning before their eyes. And so that drew a lot of attention in its span and in its time period. There was a few days then of national coverage of the Upstairs Lounge Fire because national media was suddenly interested in this. It was like a true crime story, this high scope of death, 32 people dead, we have to devote coverage to it. So the LA Times makes it a front page story. The Chicago Tribune makes it a front page story. National TV news covers the Upstairs Lounge Fire. Then it became understood the type of bar that had burned and the character of the individuals, the qualities of the individuals who had died within it. And then national media suddenly understood that this wasn't a typical true crime story where the victims would be allotted all the ordinary sympathies. In the 70s, though, queer folk were considered to be of a criminal class. State laws and also local ordinances that meant to clamp down upon what was considered a very dangerous subpopulation in the United States. And so the idea that attention had been paid to this freaked the media out, freaked authorities out, and they diverted very quickly, as what happens when anyone gets awkward. They'd scattered. Even though national media scattered, there was a persistent group of local and national queer journalists that tried to continue the story for about a week. They kept at it. There were activists that kept at it. And then those activists formed what was called the National New Orleans Emergency Task Force, and they created an emergency fund and all sorts of things like that. And they kept at it for a few months, and then that all faltered. And then there was sort of local silence. There had been an older institution that had regulated queer life called Euphemistic Living or The Closet or The Gay Underworld or Open Secret, The Social Compact, however you want to reference it. And that clamped back. And the Upstairs Lounge was then foisted locally as this example of what happens when you out yourself. What are the dangers of outness? It's violence. It's you being subjected to dangerous living and a miserable death, that sort of thing. And so the Upstairs Lounge was then utilized as this sort of cautionary tale by semi-closeted New Orleanians, people from Louisiana, that would say, this is an example of why we shouldn't be out open, using our real names, showing our faces, fighting for our rights. And we certainly shouldn't be involved in politics, saying that we're homosexuals. That was the majority voice, but then there was a minority voice locally of activists that were activated. They were like the slow burning embers stoked by the Upstairs Lounge tragedy who kept chatting about it. And they would do so for years. And they became some of the most important gay New Orleans and lesbian New Orleans activists. And then they in turn became some of the most important gay activists in Louisiana. A classic example of someone who was inspired to activism by the Upstairs Lounge tragedy was the lesbian bar owner in New Orleans, Charlene Snyder, who operated the lesbian bar Charlene's. In her outrage over the way that the Upstairs Lounge victims were treated in death, she became convinced the myth of live and let live in New Orleans, the idea that I can do my dirty thing in my corner and you can do your dirty thing in your corner and we're not going to get punished for it. The idea that that was a ruse because gays were consistently still being targeted within that atmosphere incensed Charlene and motivated her to open up. It was a radical act. She, in 1977, opened up a bar for gay women and used her real name. And that was directly connected to her experience with the Upstairs Lounge tragedy. Then there was this long battle. I could talk about this forever. Decades. Where New Orleans fought itself about whether or not it was even okay to talk about the fire. And there were parties for and against. And people like Charlene were saying we needed to talk about this and we need to connect it to a legacy of political action. And people like the former Upstairs Lounge bar owners, Phil and Stevie, would say, no, New Orleans, live and let live is the way that makes things safe. There's no gay activists in New Orleans because none are needed. That was ongoing up until the first scholarship of the Upstairs Lounge tragedy, which happens in the late 80s and early 90s. There are local writers then and journalists that try to revisit the story. And then that continues into the 21st century, where there is a tremendous explosion of scholarship and interest and discussion, first locally, then nationally, then internationally, of the Upstairs Lounge fire, where now it's not just debated whether we should talk about this event or connect it to a legacy of queer rights or queer well-being, et cetera, but it's the subject of musicals that are touring internationally. There's an Upstairs Lounge musical called The View Upstairs that recently played in Tokyo, translated into Japanese. These are folks in Tokyo, in Japanese, singing about something that happened to closeted gay folk in the 1970s French Quarter. It's insane when you think about it. There are German feature story writers right now that are writing stories about the 50th anniversary of the Upstairs Lounge and thinking about what does this mean for the legacy of international queer folk. That's a tremendous growth. The seed of activism and interest was like, I hate to use the biblical mustard seed allusion, but I am a gay Roman Catholic. So it's like it grew into the largest tree where there's never been more discussion. And that sort of exponential growth will continue to happen with the Upstairs Lounge fire. But first, in a natural storytelling city like New Orleans, the Upstairs Lounge fire for a long span of time was the one story that was off limits. No more.
We are approaching the 50th anniversary of the fire, June 24th, 2023. Does the queer LGBTQ community have any plans to mark the event in New Orleans?
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of public programming internationally and locally that's going to happen. I'm a board member of a local organization called the LGBT Archives Project of Louisiana, and we have a planning committee that's putting on a conference symposium for 3 days in New Orleans to be held at the Marriott Hotel, which is across the street from the historic site of the Upstairs Lounge Bar. And we're going to host 3 days of discussion, of meetings, and of tribute, where there's going to be all of the authors who've written books on the Upstairs Lounge. We're all going to get together and have a confab. All the people who've done artistic interpretations, people who've made musicals, created dance pieces, written screenplays, they're going to all get together and talk about things. Academics, religious folk, right, who've preached, elegized in some way the victims of the Upstairs Lounge tragedy, their input and their impact. It's going to be an extensive thing. So it's June 23rd. Through June 25th. And of course, June 24th is the actual 50th anniversary of the tragedy. And in that afternoon, there's going to be a very meaningful service at the historic St. Mark's Church, which is the church that on July 1st, 1973, held the first Upstairs Lounge memorial in the French Quarter. And then there's going to be a second line that leads us to the Upstairs Lounge historical site, whereby there's going to be a small ceremony at the plaque where the Upstairs Lounge existed, where the Upstairs Lounge fell on the map. And there's going to be a meaningful service. So there's going to be a combination of conversation, tribute, et cetera, to recognize this important event, to educate the public, to offer respect to the victims, and also to try to, as much as we can, continue to tell the victims' stories. And the victims of the Upstairs Lounge fire were not just significant because of the way they happened to die, right? A lot of these individuals led fascinating lives, each of them. You could make 32 movies out of each and every one of the individuals who perished at the Upstairs Lounge. So fascinating was that the way that these were individuals who moved between worlds, who figured out how to live in very difficult circumstances. And all of them had a unique way of coming to the upstairs lounge that night, that bar that they considered their safe haven.
And if people want to get involved?
Yep, I would go to the LGBT Archives Project website, and you can find more information there. And there's an Eventbrite page and all sorts of stuff like that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Bobby. This was a presentation of the Preservation Technology Podcast, produced by the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training. To find more podcasts like this one, please visit our website,